Chief Justice, Justices Holland, Justice Berger, Bruce Rogers, on behalf of the appellant, may it please the court, the matter arises this morning, this afternoon, as a result of the appeal of a writ of mandamus that was filed with the Superior Court. The Superior Court granted a motion for summary judgment on that writ of mandamus, which was filed on behalf of several officers of the Georgetown Police Department. The writ of mandamus follows the decision by the Criminal Justice Council and a subsequent decision by the Town of Georgetown Town Council with regards to penalties which were imposed upon certain officers. The officers were penalized based upon a violation of a verbal order which occurred as a result of the Chief of Police of the Town of Georgetown Police Department, which was issued in a meeting in December. At that meeting, the Chief of Police, with the presence of the town manager and others, including the mayor, indicated that no one was required or no one was to speak of any police matters outside going through the chain of command. The officers acknowledged in appearing before the investigator and also before the Criminal Justice Council that they had violated that order. The violation of the order resulted in an investigation which was conducted. The investigation resulted in a finding of substantial evidence which was ultimately appealed to the Criminal Justice Council. What brings us here, based upon the appeal that we have today, are the factors which went into the violation of what we consider the violation of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. The Smith, the Rosario, the Knox cases all speak of the enhanced procedural protections which are available under the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. And what was raised by the appellant in the mandamus action and also before the Criminal Justice Council were violations or what we consider to be violations of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. Initially, there were a multiple number of violations which were technical in nature, which gave rise to the violations which gave pause, if you will, to the appeal. Most notably, one of the largest procedural issues that we saw on this procedural perspective was the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights at the very early stage speaks of the fact that once the investigating officer has completed the investigation, the results, the interview, the findings of that investigation are to be turned over to those being investigated. That did not occur in this case. What did transpire is the results of that investigation were then shared with the captain, Captain Holm. Captain Holm then made the decision based upon the results of the investigation which charges to proceed with. We submit that when the request was made before the Criminal Justice Council to have those reports and that investigation from Officer Richardson from the Dover Police Department, who was the investigator, the denial of that information was a technical violation of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. We did not know what Officer Sergeant Richardson had done with regards to his investigation. We didn't know whether it was exculpatory or inculpatory. We believe that under the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, we should have had access to that information. It is compounded by the fact, or compounded by the concern that we have, that one of the other violations of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights was that the officers were entitled to know who the complainant was. The person who had initiated the complaint, which had caused the investigation to occur. One presumes that it was Captain Holm, but when we were never presented with the original information from Captain Holm, if he was indeed the one who had initiated the complaint.
Can I stop you for a moment?
Yes, Justice Berger.
I think at the very beginning, you indicated that the officers involved here admitted that they had the conversations that were prohibited, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I gather at no point were they trying to say, no, this didn't happen, were they?
No, Justice Berger, they did not.
Okay. So that being the case, what investigation had to happen and what was so important about you getting a copy of the investigation, and you're talking about whether it was exculpatory or not. You know, I may be oversimplifying here, but the chief says you can't talk about police business to members of the council. You go through the police hierarchy. Officers said, yeah, I hear you, and then went and did what they were told they couldn't do. What more is there in the way of either investigation or evidence or exculpatory evidence or any of those things?
Well, the point that was raised by the officers not only or attempted to be raised to the Criminal Justice Council and which has attempted to be raised thus far is that there was no opportunity for the officers to explain. And so the question, I think, begging the question, if I understand where the justice is going, one of the points would then become, is the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights a strict liability type of statute? Is the only question, did you or didn't you? If the only question becomes, did you or didn't you? In this instance, the officers were indicating that they had attempted to file, or they had attempted to follow proper procedures or grievances that had gone nowhere because the chief was at the top of the command, that they had deviated from that that chain of command by going outside, acknowledging that fact, but they wanted the opportunity to explain why that had to occur in this instance. None of that information was presented, or none of that information was gathered. It was given in the interviews with Officer Richardson, but we were never able to find out what else Officer Richardson had done. Some of the other complicating concerns that we had is there were seven officers who were at this meeting, three of which wound up as petitioners in this case, one of which accepted a reprimand and then became the witness in chief against these officers. But we were not permitted to explore not permitted to elaborate on the issues of mitigation or the issues of excuse as to why this order was violated.
I thought the record reflected that after Richardson's investigation, he had looked into four charges and decided not to pursue three.
My understanding is that Richardson had conducted his investigation, made that investigation to Captain Holm, and then Captain Holm made the decision that three were either unsubstantiated or not supported by evidence, and one would continue, and that was the insubordination.
And does the record, I think I read in somebody's brief that Captain Holm summarized what he had heard from Richardson, is that correct?
That was the submission, but we simply don't know.
At what point were the officers first entitled to a hearing of some kind?
Following the decision by what would then be the captain to impose the penalty, the officers were granted under Chapter 92 the ability to request a hearing.
At that point, did they have the information that had been gathered by the investigating officer from Dover?
No. What we had was, as Justice Holland had referred to, what was represented to have been the compilation of that information that Officer Richardson had gathered, having gone through the filter of...
Okay, and when the statute says that the investigating officer's information is to be given to the officers that are the subject of a complaint, does it talk about at what stage, when, in other words?
It does. The Chapter 9200 speaks of the process which is to go forward, and it talks about the decisions being based on substantial evidence. And the decision, once that decision is made, a penalty decision or a disciplinary decision, is based upon a finding by the investigator that substantial evidence exists. It's from that point when the request for the appeal, or excuse me, the request for the hearing goes forward. So I would submit that based upon the logical read of the statute, it would be at that period of time when we are given the charging document, if you will, or the charge that was preceded in this case, that much akin to the Superior Court Criminal Rule 16 discovery.
Well, now I'm confused because I think you just said that it's the investigating officer that determines what's substantiated, but you earlier said it was Captain Holm who reviews what the investigating officer compiled, who decided what charges would go forward and which were unsubstantiated.
Then I apologize. I misspoke. It was the former, that the investigating officer in this instance made the report to Captain Holm, and then Captain Holm made the decision what was substantiated and what was not, as we understand.
And what would be the purpose of having the information then, because there's no hearing at that stage, until after Captain Holm decided there was something, at least in his mind, substantiated that might trigger a right to a hearing?
It should have certainly been disclosed at some time prior to the hearing. The timing part, I certainly cannot say that it's a bright line distinction, that the timing part would be
okay,
that...
So we have two issues here. One, let's call it due process for lack of a better term. All the information that could have been made available to them to assist them in their defense was not made available to them before the hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Number one. And when information was made available to them, was it what the investigating officer compiled, or was it what was filtered through Captain Holm's review of that information?
It was what Captain Holm had filtered through the investigation. The information that was in the record indicated that it was Captain Holm that had reviewed what Officer Richardson from Dover had gathered in his investigation and based his decision based on, from that.
All right. Given what the officers conceded was a fact, describe to us the prejudice caused by that.
if indeed there were four charges which we began with, and if Officer Richardson had conducted something, or if he had found something in there which would have mitigated against the liability of the officers on the other charges which set forth, we would like to have known if there was some sort of mitigation evidence in which to be able to present that mitigation evidence. He obviously, when this officer did his investigation, when this officer had conducted his investigation and said this to Captain Holm, here are the four charges. Clearly, much akin, and since the statute, since Chapter 92 refers to an officer being found guilty, I can equate this to the criminal law. We should certainly be entitled to all that which is available there to determine whether or not it does have either relevant admissible evidence or can lead to relevant and admissible evidence.
Not just to guilt, but to the appropriate punishment as well?
I would submit that as the statute is done, and the statute is kind of difficult to follow when it comes to the hearing versus the penalty, because as the court can see from the record in this case, the hearing was conducted by the three-judge panel of the Criminal Justice Council with a request by the town not to impose a penalty, leaving that to Chief Topping to impose the penalty. In this instance, I believe that looking at the results of that investigation would have been relevant for us to be able to argue on a penalty phase, on the mitigation phase to the CJC, but it would have been relevant for us to be able to argue that information. Okay. Following from that regard, one of the other issues which gave rise to the writ of mandamus and the appeal in this instance is the fact that the Criminal Justice Council, in its opinion, which the court has before in both briefs, in both Mr. Morris's brief and mine, the Criminal Justice Council did make reference to the fact that there were interesting or troubling concerns, for example, of a First Amendment concern. But that was beyond the can or beyond the scope of what the Criminal Justice Council three-judge panel or the three-person panel was there to hear. Part of where the problem arises is the consistent interpretation that we have seen over the years, and I was involved in the Smith case back in 1999, and have seen consistently applying. The standard that the CJC has applied throughout this is that substantial evidence is really almost a strict liability argument. It either it is or it is not. The point then becomes, if it is simply a yes or a no, and the CJC has in this instance denied any evidence on mitigation, denied any challenge to the underlying order, the hearing itself becomes almost a right without a remedy. Because if you're not able to argue that the underlying right itself or the underlying order itself was not valid, or the application or the implementation of the order was not valid, then the hearing itself becomes a strict liability offense, which is what Justice Berger had indicated in this case.
Well, it's not a strict liability event if the officer denies that whatever he's charged with happened.
Exactly. In those instances where an officer contests the factual circumstances.
But I guess my concern is this. If the purpose of the LIBOR, is that the way it's said? If the purpose of all of those provisions is to make sure that officers have a process by which they can have their concerns heard and any potential punishment be considered or reviewed, it doesn't necessarily include the ability to argue that this was a bad rule, for example. We violated it, but we think it was a bad rule, and we want you to decide, was this a bad rule or not? Along the same lines, we think we have a First Amendment right to say whatever we want to whomever we want, and this order says we can't, so we want to have an argument about constitutional law. Is that what LIBOR is there for?
Submitted, yeah. And in this instance, that's exactly where this leads to. One of the issues that we have is that with the writ of mandamus, there cannot be any adequate remedy at law. In this particular instance, without having the ability to challenge that underlying order through the Criminal Justice Council, the Criminal Justice Council will hold their hearing, agree or disagree that it's supported by substantial evidence, and then from that period of time, the only remedy that had is a remedy for damages. It is submitted that it is the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights. If it's going to offer enhanced procedural protections, if the procedural protections are going to be such that we're going to be able to follow the process which is due and be able to present those factors which are relevant we submit for the inquiry, then that's the point at which to do that, rather than on an appeal. The Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, if it is simply governed, if it's simply viewed as a technical statute, if it's a technical statute and the only question becomes yay or nay, then there are really no procedural safeguards, or there are no safeguards for officers who challenge the underlying order. It's almost as a Nuremberg.
Okay. Is there any case law that says if an officer feels that some regulation is invalid or unwarranted or whatever, wrong, that officer can then ignore whatever the order or requirement is and then go through a process where the council and eventually the courts will decide, was that a good or bad order?
Heretofore, there has been nothing ruled by the courts which would indicate that that's the proper procedure to take. And that's the reason that we've proceeded as far as we
have. Appeal. What do you see happening next?
Perhaps some guidance could be taken from the Rosario case of Judge Witham. One of the two opportunities could be either to remand this consistent with the proceeding starting back from the beginning, where we have the opportunity to acquire what Detective Richardson or Sergeant Richardson had and move from that point forward. We also are seeking to have the Criminal Justice Council, through Mr. Tupman, who along with me was involved in Smith back in 1999, interpret that portion of the hearing part to say that it is simply not a black and white substantial evidence part. Substantial evidence must be able to include more. So one opportunity would be for a rehearing with that evidence there.
That before the Criminal Justice Council, your clients had no opportunity to explain why they violated the order at all.
That's correct. Mr. Tupman had rendered the opinion to the council that in addition to discovery and motions to compel and time and other and elsewise, Mr. Tupman's position as counsel to the Criminal Justice Council was the only point you're asking is substantial evidence to support. You're not going to get into any of the other issues.
Were the issues that you refer to as the other issues raised before the Criminal Justice Council and then again before Superior Court?
All of the issues with regards to discovery, motions to compel, and the multitude of issues were raised by counsel pre-trial with Mr. Tupman on behalf of...
Well, I'm interested in all the other issues, as in, was there a First Amendment violation claim raised before the Criminal Justice Council and before Superior Court?
The First Amendment claim was presented through the Criminal Justice Council. That's the reason you see as part of the, I believe, in the argument portion. No evidence. We were able to argue through Mr. Tupman's good graces that we were able to get into that perspective, but we were not able to argue anything further as to the mitigation perspectives. The Superior Court relied upon that record, which was before the Criminal Justice Council. So the only record that it had before it was that which would had been submitted
well,
by counsel that wasn't
the nature
argument.
Of the petition for a writ of mandamus.
I understand.
Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What part of the Superior Court's order do you disagree with? As I understand it, the Superior Court granted summary judgment on the basis there is no genuine issue of material fact, and then denied your petition for a writ of mandamus as a matter of law.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
How did the judge get it wrong?
If we look at Rosario for guidance, I believe that we have a conflict. We have Judge Stokes doing it summary judgment, then mandamus. Judge Witham did it mandamus, then summary judgment. We submit that the issue on mandamus would have been the procedural problems that we saw, the investigation issues, the fact that we had the substantial evidence questions with regards, the fact that we didn't know the person who was the complaining witness to begin with. We submit that those were material issues of fact which needed to be resolved.
What was the remedy you sought through the writ of mandamus?
The writ of mandamus was to have the matter cleared from the record and remanded, which would be what we would see here. One of the options under Rosario.
Remanded for entirely new hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, tell me the connection between your client's admissions and what you're characterizing as the substantial evidence question.
The issue with regards to what the client admitted to violating the order. The reason the client had violated the order, it was because of the invalidity of the order and the fact that the order, in being complied with, presented substantial questions of police officer safety, of the concern within the department, of materials which were being used with regards to expired bulletproof vests, for example. None of those issues could be raised because the only thing that the CJC had limited them to was a substantial question with regards to guilt or innocence on that underlying petition.
And then we're back to Justice Berger's question. Your contention is that this is a procedural mechanism to contest the validity of orders?
I believe that in order for the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights to have any value whatsoever to officers who are charged under it, they must be able to present the panoply of issues before that panel, that criminal justice council, in order to have a full and fair hearing of what they're there for. That would include evidence of mitigation. That would include evidence which would say that the underlying order that they're charged with violating with would be invalid.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Holland. I want to address, before I start my argument, I have prepared a couple questions which have already been asked of Mr. Rogers. First of all, question by Justice Holland was, did you have an opportunity to present mitigation issues to the board? In fact, they did. Their main argument through the entire process, and particularly at the board, was, you know, we kept going to the chief. We kept making our complaints to him verbally, and he just wasn't doing anything. And each one of them, all the officers who testified, made that argument. So, yes, they had the opportunity, and there was no objection from Mr. Liguori, my partner, who was present, to object to that. There was no statements made by the attorney for the board or any of the board members that, no, we're not listening to that.
Can I stop you here?
Yes.
Let's assume, as a hypothetical, that the chief of police has ordered that from now on, police officers who are going on drug interventions or efforts to catch drug dealers will be able to carry guns, but they won't be able to have bullets in them. And the police officers, with some understandably, say this doesn't make any sense, this puts our lives in jeopardy, it's not good police methodology, and so forth and so on. What remedy would they have, other than, I guess, quitting, if they go to the police chief who imposed this new regulation and said, hey, here's the reasons why this is a bad idea, you got to change your mind, and the police chief says, nope, this is the way it's going to be? What could they do at that point?
Well, what the officers could have done in this case is filed a proper grievance procedure.
Well, I'm saying, what kind of procedure is available if an officer has a good faith belief that a regulation or rule or order is invalid for whatever reason, but I'm making it an extreme reason because for the purposes of the discussion?
Well, again, initially, I think they have the obligation to file any contracts or policies or procedures through their department or through the town, and to grieve that, because that's their ability in a paramilitary type organization. There are orders issued, and if you have a problem, you have to go through the proper procedures to object to those.
Okay, and let's say they grieve it, and it goes, the grievance gets up to the chief, who denies it, right? Because he's the one who entered the order.
Correct.
Where do they go from there?
Well, it depends. And for the town of Georgetown, essentially there are three types of grievance procedures. One for the Georgetown Police Department goes to the chief. There is one for the collective bargaining agreement, which also goes to the chief. But there, in the town of Georgetown, there is one other, which applies to all town of Georgetown members, which could potentially go to the town manager, who could make, you know, potentially decision on whether the order would be appropriate or not. Because in that, in your hypothetical, that's obvious. That's an improper order. And yes, I think they could be able to grieve that grieve it through the proper process.
But you're saying that if you grieve it to the chief and the chief denies your grievance, you've got no rights beyond that with respect to your grievance, right?
Other than with the town of Georgetown, they could take their grievance through the town's grievance procedure, and it would get beyond the chief of police.
It would get to the town manager?
That's my understanding of
it. And what happens after that?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think that's where it stops. It goes to the town manager ultimately.
Okay, so arguably there is no way to deal with this kind of situation short of quitting.
Correct.
Other than to refuse to obey the order.
And then they would be in a similar situation where they would have to try to explain it to potentially the Criminal Justice Council, which whether or not they could take that into account. Because what's interesting is one other question that was raised, and I believe it was you, Chief Justice, that was the First Amendment issue raised. Initially, when I got the decision, again, I didn't do the hearing below, my partner handled it. And I got the decision from the Deputy Attorney General. It mentions in the last paragraph, interestingly enough, it may be a constitutional issue. And I made an assumption, one thing they always teach in law school, never make an assumption. And I did. And I assumed that at some point during that process, it had been raised. Over the last couple of days in preparing for this hearing, I have reviewed the entire transcript. I've reviewed correspondence. And I have yet to see where it was raised. Now, I could be wrong, and hopefully Mr. Rogers will tell me that I'm wrong.
Well, was it raised in Superior Court as a basis for a granting a petition for a writ of mandamus?
It was mentioned in one subparagraph that they failed to protect his client's constitutional right. And because Judge Stokes' decision actually mentions, because when I read Judge Stokes' decision, it initially said they failed to raise it below. But also, I don't believe that the board is normal to address constitutional issues. So that's what caught me by surprise when I saw that decision. I was like, well, maybe they didn't raise it. So I did look throughout the whole process, and I didn't see it specifically where they raised that issue. It looks like the Deputy Attorney General or possibly one of the CJC members raised it, and they basically put it as a small blurb in their opinion from what I saw.
Well, let me ask you this question. Given the fact that the Superior Court judge found there were no genuine issues of material fact, why is there a difference before us about whether mitigation was allowed before the CJC?
I don't see where mitigation comes involved here. They either violated the order or they didn't violate the order. In this case...
Well, then what's the answer? Was there... I thought you just said they had an opportunity to raise issues of mitigation and that they did.
And they did. And the board apparently, other than potentially a constitutional issue, did not buy into it.
I mean, did not consider it.
It did not consider it. And the reason why they didn't consider it, because if you look at the board's decision, one of the, and let me quote, they mentioned it was important in the CJC's decision was that there were legitimate procedural mechanisms for the officers to air the dissatisfaction with the department. There were potentially three avenues where the appellants could have filed three different grievance procedures to air their complaints, and they purposely chose not to avail themselves of any of them. So I believe, based on what I saw in the transcript, they were able to present their mitigation that, hey, we're just not getting a response from the chief. CJC actually looked at it and said, well, no, you didn't do the steps that you should have to avail yourself.
Do you agree with the fact that's been suggested here that the investigating officer from Dover's material was not presented to the officers at any stage before they had a hearing?
Totally disagree, and that was one of the other questions that I was going to respond to. The only thing generated by Detective Richardson from the City of Dover Police Department were statements that he took from each and every officer that was involved. Those transcribed statements are the only reports, written reports, from my understanding, that were ever produced by Detective Richardson. So there aren't, they keep saying, well, we want them. There's nothing to produce. His work product consisted of the transcript statements that he took.
If that's all of his work product, is that what the statute contemplates to be, all of his work product? Is there supposed to be an investigative log that tracks on a daily basis what it was he did during the course of his investigation, and that would be subject to review?
I don't think there is any requirement under the statute that there be an administrative log. I do not see that language any place in that statute. Yes, it does say he has to produce any and all records that he produces or reports. In this case, he did not produce any written reports. The only thing he did is he came to the station, took statements from each and every individual. Those statements were in fact transcribed. He presented them to Home. Presumably, they discussed his investigation, but there is nothing else written in nature that can be produced or would be ever be able to be produced to them.
And the third issue that's of concern to me is the statute appears to contemplate that the investigating officer should come from within the department where the alleged violation occurred. That didn't happen here.
It did not.
Why not?
I think it was obvious that you had numerous members, approximately seven, I believe, in total, who were involved in this attempted coup or whatever you want to call it. And that, again, we're talking about a small department of maybe 14 total at best. And that I think the chief or the captain made a reasonable, probably, thought process that it may be in everyone's best interest we have someone neutral look into this. So he approached, my understanding, the town officials to designate Detective Richardson to come and do the interviews. In fact, that was noted by Judge Stokes that it was actually to their benefit to have that done.
Now, I noted that Judge Stokes did say that, and the question ultimately becomes, who makes that policy judgment? The legislature and the statute, or police chiefs and police town or town government that supervises the police on an ad hoc basis, case by case, town by town, or do you follow the statute?
I think you follow the statute, but it says someone from the department who has been designated. The question is, does the town have the ability to bring in someone else to be a peace officer, investigator, whatever, and to designate that person basically to become part of the town to do an investigation on their behalf? I think that's the real question, and I think that the chief and the town, if they agreed to it, would have that capability.
Well, then what is the purpose of the language of the statute? Is it plain English? Is there something ambiguous about it?
I think it's plain English. But it says that someone who the town or whoever's part of the town that's done it. And I think, again,
I doubt that's what the statute says. Does the statute say?
Bear with me 1 second.
I'm trying to rationalize the language in the statute with the exercise of reasoned discretion that you described. I don't think any of us have any difficulty understanding the argument that you made about why it would be reasonable to deviate from the statute. But the real question is, are you allowed to deviate from the literal language of the statute?
I believe you are allowed to deviate to the point that whether the town has the ability to make someone or designate to be part of their police department, at least for a specific purpose. My argument would be that he actually became a part of that police department based upon the request.
The statutory language says an investigation by an authorized member of the department. At any time was Sergeant Richardson from Dover an authorized member of the Georgetown Police Department?
Absolutely he was. And he was authorized because the chief had at least forethought that it would probably be in everyone's best interest to have someone do it that wasn't part of a small town police department. And with that thought, he even had the initiative to not only do that himself, but to get permission from the town council and those individuals to get that authorization. So I believe he is authorized under that reading.
You mean authorized to do the investigation, or he's an authorized member of the department?
I think for the purpose of doing the investigation, he is an authorized member of the department.
Well, isn't it a fair reading of the statute that it's supposed to be somebody from within the police force, the same police force? And I, you know, I understand the idea and what the trial judge thought was the result that, oh, this is even more fair than what the statute requires because we're going to bring in somebody from outside. But arguably, part of the reason that's in there is because somebody who's within that police department brings with him or her a level of understanding of how that department operates that an outsider wouldn't have. And maybe that is, in fact, a better person to be reviewing a police officer's problems than somebody from outside.
That makes sense to me, Your Honor. But I think getting back to the real situation is whether Detective Richardson could become an authorized member of the department.
Well, does the record contain a resolution of the town council or anything, any letters, correspondence? Where do we read the authority that was requested and given?
I don't know the answer to that question, Justice Hahn. I don't believe that there's probably any proclamation that says that.
Yeah, no one's suggesting anything about the outcome of the case by asking the questions, but no one's questioning that you have a rational basis for an argument that this, as the trial judge found, could even be more fair from that perspective. But the question for us is, as a matter of law, who sets the policy? And this is literal language taken from the General Assembly's statute, and our job is to enforce the statute.
Understood, and I think that the word authorized helps us in that argument, that he became an authorized member of that department based upon essentially an appointment process where someone reached out on behalf of the town and said, we want you to do this investigation on our behalf.
At the risk of revisiting something we've already visited, we've heard Mr. Rogers' point of view on what information Sergeant Richardson may have had or had gathered during the course of his investigation. We've heard your answer to what it actually was. But the statute does say the information is to come from the investigating officer to the person who's alleged to have violated the order in this case. What came to them and when? From whom?
What came from Detective Richardson was the transcribed statements which were turned over to Mr. Rogers.
I thought there was an intermediary. Were they turned over directly?
In all fairness, I don't know specifically the answer to that question. What I suspect happened is they were turned over.
Instead of suspecting what happened, you either know what the record says and you're in a position to disagree with the representations made by Mr. Rogers, or you are not.
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm assuming that it was turned over to Detective Holm, which then was turned over to Mr. LaGuardia. But I don't know specifically the answer to that question.
If that is the case, which is being argued to us, and that would be inconsistent with the statute, wouldn't it?
No, as long as it was turned over in a reasonable time fashion, in which it was. I mean, they had access to everything that Detective Richardson produced.
Well, we heard Mr. Rogers say they did not have access to that information before the hearing.
And that's 100% incorrect. Mr. LaGuardia took the entire Georgetown Police Department file with him and went to his office, put it on a table, and said, have at it, you have access to everything that you want. So that statement is 100% wrong. One of the main things I do want to address is, and it was a little bit concerning to me in Mr. Rogers' opening brief, that he alleges that the court failed to address 9 of arguments that he raised. I went back through the original writ of mandamus complaint, and the court did address each and every allegation which they raised. I believe Mr. Rogers was confused. It took me a while to figure it out because it caused me a concern when it was stated that the court simply ignored 9 of their arguments, and that's not true. When I looked at the other pending case, which is in Superior Court, I believe that's where the additional 9 arguments are, but they were not alleged in the writ of mandamus complaint. Each and every allegation, and it would be paragraphs 12, 14, and 16 of the writ of mandamus, set forth each in detail each and every allegation or complaint they're making. And
Excuse me.
Yes.
You just said something that causes me concern. There's another case involving these issues that's still in Superior Court?
Yes, there is.
Why do we have 2 cases about the same thing?
That's what I put in my brief, that there's an adequate remedy of law here. And that's one of the requirements for the writ of mandamus, and I don't know how they get over that hurdle.
Is that a finding that Judge Stokes made as well?
There was an original complaint. I believe there were 7 counts. He dismissed 6 counts. The last count included constitutional issues. Those arguments have been fully briefed, and it's my understanding, again, we're not handling that part of the claim, but it's my understanding those constitutional claims are set for oral argument sometime in April.
Is Mr. Rogers the attorney in that case?
Yes, he is. He was, and they I believe there was a recent substitution of counsel. So,
is the same relief being sought in both this mandamus action and the other case?
Well, I think in that case they're more seeking compensatory damages, monetary damages. But the fact pattern, as it at least existed in the initial complaint, was almost identical. Similar allegations, but they made approximately 9 more claims that it was a violation of the Lee Abor.
Is that complaint in Superior Court?
Yes, it is.
And it will allow them, when there's a final judgment, to take an appeal to us?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what we're here about is the nature of the vehicle of a petition for a writ of mandamus, more than being asked to finally resolve a controversy between two parties.
That's correct.
Because we won't be able to do that.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't have anything further unless there's more questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You used your time on your direct argument. So we are concluded. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.